such meaningless thought. The shell appears strong, but the inside is rot. It's time to be stirred. The time is now. The winds have changed. Read the signs. No time to hide. The winds have changed.
Millennia ago, from the little cave on the tiny island of Patmos in the Aegean Sea, the heavens opened. Since then, the world has been fascinated by the cosmic upheaval brewing on the horizon of history. The upheaval is now upon us. It is within us. To some degree, it always has been. But there has been a sudden and violent shift in the affairs of the world. The winds have changed. Heaven will not be silent. Let's now join Father Anthony Bush, pastor of St. Stanislaus Kostka, the Sanctuary of the Divine Mercy in Chicago, and author of A Mother's Plea, For the Winds Have Changed. Together we can pave the way for a hopeful response to the signs of our times.
Hey, welcome everyone. Welcome. God bless you. Welcome everyone. God bless you for tuning in to The Winds Have Changed. Father Tom Coyce here, hoping to wrinkle your brains a little bit here, and let's see if we, all our apparatuses, apparati. There we go. Thanks, Nick. I think that works. Might be a little too much. Okay. How about that? welcome, Tony. Thanks for being here.
Good to be here, Father.
Again. And as we have to do, we have to wrinkle your brain a little bit, and okay, there we go.
That sounds better.
Wow. You just wrinkled my brain, man.
That's early.
There we go. And
sorry, I couldn't keep those guys out.
Indeed. We're going to have to go back to the 16th century again. I'm sorry. This is a topic that just won't get out of my craw? Craw, there you go. That's the word I was looking for. It's stuck in my craw. And here is a good introductory quote. In the past couple of weeks, I've been trying to share some insights into the Protestant Reformation vis-a-vis a very intelligent and bold author by the name of Hilaire Belloc. There's a book called Characters of the Reformation. And he says at the beginning just exactly what it does to me. He says,
Danger, Will Robinson. You just wrinkled danger. My brain, man.
Yeah. That was a double shot.
There is danger in going back to this part of history. I'm glad Nick reminded me of that, because the danger is uncovering dirty laundry from the past, and oftentimes a way to have peace in your life today is to forget the dirty laundry of the past. You know what I'm saying? People, we have to do that all the time.
So is this where we practice holy forgetfulness?
Exactly. This is where we have to practice holy forgetfulness, because I'm astutely aware that people are walking around in unholy forgetfulness. And I didn't realize it until just recently, but I noticed that the foreword to the book is written by Marcus Grodi, who some of you probably know as a speaker on EWTN. He hosts that Coming Home Network, and Coming Home Network is one of the more interesting shows that EWTN has. It tells the stories of many of the Protestant ministers who are becoming Catholic, and they tell their story, and there's so many common threads. And Marcus Grodi wrote this foreword to this new edition of Characters of the Reformation. And I'm just going to say, he quotes something of Belloc, which is why he thinks the book is so important, why I think this topic is so important, why I can't get it out of my craw, as it were, and why I'm continually trying to wrinkle people's brains about it. Because in one sense, the misinterpretation of this part of history has wrinkled our brains in one way. We have to smooth our brains out and re-wrinkle them in another way.
It's a daily occurrence.
So does that make any sense?
Yes, it does.
He says, here's what Marcus Grodi quotes. He says, Europe today, with all her culture, is now seriously imperiled and stands no small chance being destroyed by her own internal disruption. And all this is ultimately the fruit of the great religious revolution which began 400 years ago. That being so, the Reformation being of this importance, it ought to form the chief object of historical study in modern times, and its nature should be clearly understood, even if only in outline. That is an incredible introduction, as it were.
Yeah.
Because us modern American Christians, both of the Protestant and Catholic kind, are very much trained to ignore the differences and emphasize the commonality, right? Mm-hmm. I mean that's a common attitude. And I don't want to say that that's not important. We do have to see our common bonds and our common beliefs. But by revisiting some of the mistakes of the past, we will be able to heal those wounds in a better way than just thinking they never existed in the first place. Does that make any sense?
Yeah.
I think that's what that's why I'm stuck on this topic here, and it's also because it's we just finished the 500th anniversary of Reformation, and the dominant theme was, let's forget about the differences of the past and work on our commonality. Let's go forward in the future. And I agree with that to a point, because the very thought of let's forget about the differences of the past requires you know the differences of the past.
Right.
If you didn't know there's any differences of the past, then you can't forget about the differences of the past. And there's that secret of holy forgetfulness.
Right.
You understand. This is a bit like sometimes when I talk with people and I try to help them get through their annulment process. And a lot of people don't like to work on an annulment because what's past is past. Why dig up the pain of the past? I want to think about today and tomorrow, the future. And I sometimes will say to if the man and the woman are there together with me, the man who's working on an annulment, let's say, and the woman who doesn't need an annulment but wants to marry the man who was divorced and needs the annulment, I'll say, if you know, this is a very touchy issue, but it's so true. If you, the woman who wants to marry the man who was married before, if you want to love him with all your heart, all your soul, all your mind, your forgiveness of his past is more powerful if you know his past.
Right.
You know, it's almost as if the opposite is so well known. Obviously, if I knew your past, I might not be able to forgive you.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Right.
And so the person's tendency to not want to know about the past is tied to the very reality that I don't want to know because I don't know if I could take it. And in that sense, going back into history and exploring the Protestant Reformation fits that category a bit. Because we live in a day, we do live in a time when Christians need to be united. And especially when there's a common enemy. Obviously, you know, the old saying, a common enemy makes friends out of former enemies. And the non-Christian world, and particularly the Islamic world, in some ways is a, I'm going to use the term, an antagonist. The Islamic world is certainly an antagonist against the Christian world today. And an interesting twist with Europe, Islam is I think, a little even more advanced than it is here in the United States. Do you get that sense, Tony,
yeah,
when you're,
I do.
When you're listening to the news and what have you? And it's not, here's an insight of epic history. I like epic historical thoughts, you know. They're all built on little stories of people's
right.
lives. But when you see and you grasp an epic issue of history, it really sticks with you. And one of those epic threads of history is the attempt to unify Europe. The attempt to unify Europe was very difficult with Christianity in the first place. And Christianity, i.e. Catholicism, which was the only kind of Christianity at the beginning, did a great deal of unifying. And even though there was a tremendous amount of division, there was a sense of some kind of unification, some principle of unity, which makes me think of modern-day America, because modern-day America is so fractured and divided, and yet the idea of the United States of America as a bunch of divided states united by a national identity and a national idea, that's kind of left over from the Holy Roman Empire. The Holy Roman Empire dissolved, and especially it was centered mostly in Germany. So Germany had the Washington, D.C., so to speak, the capital of the Holy Roman Empire. So it had a very strong sense that we were in charge of some kind of unifying systems, unifying beliefs, unifying creed. And indeed, it was a creed, a religious creed. And so, but as the Protestant Reformation came, it destroyed the Holy Roman Empire. And Hilaire Belloc is saying that Europe has never been the same. And I think that's so true. The European Union today is now another try at unifying Europe. But the European Union is so secular and has none of the spiritual or eternal dogmas and beliefs of Catholicism that it's not doing a very good job. Does that make any sense?
Yeah.
I can see. Throw out any questions you might have, Tony.
Gotcha.
As we go into this.
You just wrinkled my brain, man.
Yeah, that's kind of where I'm at right now.
That's the wrinkling of the brain.
Yeah.
So Marcus Grody gives a good introduction or a good reason why I am, I want to say stuck. I was going to say obsessed. I don't want to feel like I'm obsessed with anything, but I'm stuck on.
Stuck is good. Yeah.
Stuck. I'm stuck on it. And I want others to appreciate what Hilaire Belloc is seeing, the tragedy that the Reformation was to modern society. And the United States tried to recover it. So the Holy Roman Empire tried to unify Europe with all the tribes and all the kingdoms, and they did somewhat. That disintegrated with the Protestant Reformation. It wasn't going to reestablish itself in Europe. I think Hilaire Belloc says it wisely, where he says the the forces of Catholicism versus Protestantism reached a kind of stalemate in Europe. That is to say, one didn't really win and one didn't really lose. And in that sense, I think we can say that Catholicism needed a reformation, no doubt about it. But Europe didn't need Protestantism. Europe didn't need the theory of fractured identity. And here's a powerful point that I didn't realize, and Hilaire Belloc spells it out very well, that it was primarily the Protestant Reformation that hooked religion as a boxcar onto the engine known as the state. So it's usually thought of as just the opposite. It's usually thought of today as Protestantism broke religion away from the state. And that is really a false description of what happened. So, okay, Nick wants us to take a little break here. We are going to do so, and we're going to keep on wrinkling your brains. I'm going to get back into a little of these characters of the Reformation. And don't go away. I'm Father Tom Coy, sitting in for Father Anthony Bush. You're listening to listener-supported The Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ.
Portions of the day's programming are reproduced by means of electrical transcriptions or tape recordings.
Get in touch with God.
Get in touch with God.
Turn your radio on.
Turn your radio on.
You've got your radio turned on to Winds of Change, where you can hear about your faith and hear about today's culture through the lens of Christ's teachings with Father Anthony Bush and others. Monday through Friday at noon on AM 750. Keep Winds of Change on by going to ststandschurch.org and click on the radio tab to donate. And Winds of Change offers thanks for your donation.
The Winds of Change.
The Winds of Change.
On AM 750. WNDZ, and on the World Wide Web at windsofchangeshow.com.
St. Stanislaus Kostka is the sanctuary of the Divine Mercy, where you can enter into the presence of Christ 24/7. Every first Saturday afternoon will be a special opportunity for healing. At 4:30, bring your petitions for our Blessed Mother's intercession as we pray the Rosary. Then, at 5, we share the body of Christ in the Holy Mass. Also, at 5:30, a Spanish Mass, followed by a Eucharistic procession, adoration, the Divine Mercy Chaplet, and an anointing. Enter into the sacred space of St. Stanislaus Kostka and place yourself before Christ for healing. On first Saturday afternoon, starting at 4:30, find St. Stanislaus Kostka, the Sanctuary of the Divine Mercy, 2 blocks north of Division, on Noble, just off the Kennedy in Chicago, and find peace and healing.
Hey, welcome back, everyone. Father,
here we go.
Father Coyce here. Tony, good to have you here.
Same here, Father. Good to be here.
It begins.
It begins. Run that one by again, Renick. How does that one?
It begins.
Yeah.
What begins? The revelation. Your mind is going to be opened.
And wrinkled.
And wrinkled. An unraveling needs to be done in order to smooth out. What I like about Marcus Grodi's introduction to Hilaire Belloc's book called Characters of the Reformation is putting it in the context of today. And he locates it in the context of the troubles that Europe is experiencing and the troubles here in the United States that we are experiencing. And he's pointing a finger, he's pointing to a cause that is not, I've never heard it be pointed to before as part of the cause of our chaos.
That's not fair. That's not fair at all.
It isn't fair.
That's not fair.
Poor guy.
That poor guy. That's from the Twilight Zone, if you know that.
Yeah.
Great Twilight Zone episode. It's not fair that history has lost these important lessons that we can uncover. Here's what Marcus Grodi puts in again here, too. Often histories of the Reformation focus on battles over doctrine and religious practice. That's certainly big in my book, I would say. Leading to debates, political upheaval, and wars. But here in Hilaire Belloc's description of the characters of the Reformation, we encounter the key people whose personalities, private lives, relationships, character, strengths, and flaws in situations shaped the conflicts that led to the divisions. And so, He points out masterfully how the call for reform by Martin Luther in the land we now call Germany was certainly a needed call for reform. There's saints and there's popes and there's bishops that all accepted and realized that the call for reform was well needed. You might say similar to what we hear today with the sex abuse scandals, that we're hearing a lot about the sex abuse scandals, but we're not quite hearing as strongly as perhaps we should the need for moral reform. There's an attempt. Did you hear recently that the Chilean bishops gathered and sent Pope Francis a corporate resignation letter?
Oh, yeah, I did hear that.
That was blows your mind, wrinkles my brain quite a bit, you know, that they are, I'm not, oh.
There you go.
You just wrinkled my brain, man.
That guy comes in all the time.
Yeah, you got to watch that guy.
I'm not sure what to make of that, actually, you know. It's a sad, sad state of affairs where all the Chilean bishops, are they sort of saying, yes, we all know that we've blown it so much that here's our letter of resignation, you know, pick new bishops. In one sense, that's kind of like in a typical war situation, you know how I like stories from the American Civil War, mm-hmm. whenever there's a general who disappoints the main general, he goes to the general and says, okay, I offer you my resignation. Here's my sword. That's kind of what the Chilean bishops were doing with Pope Francis. I'll offer you my sword. You can pick a new leader. And, of course, in a war situation, oftentimes, whether it's Robert E. Lee leading the Confederacy or General Patton leading the American forces in World War II, the chief general thinks I can't pick a new guy. you're all I got to work with, you know. And in a little cynical side of me is interpreting what the Chilean bishops did as kind of like, in a certain sense, calling the Pope's bluff. In a sense, okay, we're all going to resign. Good luck with your church. We're out of here.
It's a way to look at it. I think about that too.
Yeah. Well, and of course, it's too tempting to think that way. It's too tempting to think that way. But here's my point. The point I want everyone to appreciate is the call to reform is so needed. We need a true sense of moral reform that is from top to bottom, from the lowliest teenage common person up to and including the bishops and the cardinals and the popes and all of us in between, that sense of reform. So Hilaire Belloc is saying that at the Protestant Reformation time, that was a call that was issued by Martin Luther. And had it been only that, the church would have survived. And the unity within diversity that we love to say today is so important. You know, you can't listen to three politicians for more than 5 minutes without hearing unity in diversity.
Just count how many times.
Isn't that true? You know, yeah. We're always talking about unity and diversity.
Do people really, really believe that? I wonder.
Well, it's a dream. It's a desire. Mm-hmm. You know, we want it. But how do we get it and what does it look like?
That might be the better discussion. How do we get there? Not that we want it. Everybody wants it, right?
Right, right. And a discussion about true moral principles has got to be part of it. So anyways, Europe went half Protestant and half Catholic was what Hilaire Belloc calls a stalemate. And stalemates are, well, I guess there's a good side and a bad side to them. The bad side is that there's no real one clear victor. If there had been one real clear victor, and hoping or presuming that could have been Catholicism, we wouldn't have had the fractured administrative actions that Protestantism brought about. And,
wow.
And especially...
You just wrinkled my brain, man.
Exactly. So, that fractured, and also the hooking of, I'm going to use this metaphor, that what the Protestant Reformation created was, it took religion, which was sort of a equal partner with the state during the time of the Holy Roman Empire. The Holy Roman Empire is filled with stories of bishops and kings battling it out, you know, or arguing it out, trying to figure out who's going to lead who where and here. And so there was a marriage of sorts. It was a rocky marriage, but it was a marriage. And what the Protestant Reformation did was it hooked the boxcar of church to the locomotive of the state. And that was a great tragedy that now then the state could use religion to its own purpose. And the church had to serve the state without upsetting the state, you know. So here's what Marcus Grodi writes about. He says, oftentimes histories of the Reformation focus on battles over doctrine and religious practice, leading to debates, political upheaval, and wars. But here we encounter the key people whose personalities, private lives, relationships, characters, strengths and flaws, and situations shaped the conflicts that led to the divisions. I think that's right on target to get into politically... Our political discourse, which is filled with great conflict today, of course, is thought to be of a much different part of life than our private life. Our private life is one thing, our political life is another thing. As a matter of fact, one of my favorite little scenes in the play Hamilton, I don't have any Hamilton to play with it right here today, but one of my favorite scenes in Hamilton is when the play goes into the quagmire that Alexander Hamilton's affair with a woman in New York while his wife was in upstate New York. And so and then somebody finds out about it and he tries to blackmail Alexander Hamilton. he says, did you know that that woman you're having an affair with is actually a married woman? He goes, oh my goodness, I didn't know that. And actually, she's married to a British officer who was the mortal enemies of the colonist revolutionists, which Alexander Hamilton was. You know, so you get into the quagmire of that personal story. And then at one point, somebody in the play screams out, can we just get back to politics? You know, it's sort of like, I don't want to have to think about these personal issues. Let's get back to politics where these things don't matter.
Right.
Which we think they don't matter.
Exactly.
But we're wrong. That's what the lesson, when we analyze the characters of the Reformation, teach us. And so what I'm trying to do to our listeners today is what Heller Belloc was trying to do, and is correct a faulty version of history. Too often, here I'm going to quote again from Marcus Grodek, too often historians portrayed the general English populace as religiously oppressed or demanding reform, or at least divided equally between preserving the old traditional Catholic religion of their English heritage or following the trajectory of mainline Protestant Europe. Belloc, however, successfully argues and demonstrates that even with all that had happened, as a result of Henry's divorce and his claim of headship of the Church of England, the most of the English population had no intention of abandoning the old religion, let alone turning their backs on the papacy. In fact, they completely supported Mary Tudor. And if she had lived longer and produced an heir, England would have remained Catholic to this day. Mary Tudor, of course, just to remind you, do you remember from last week, Tony, you remind us, Mary Tudor was the daughter of Henry VIII and Catherine of Aragon. That's what you were going to say, right?
That's what I was going to say.
You knew it. Yeah. It was right at the tip of your tongue. She was the legitimate heir to the throne.
Right.
And underlined legitimate because Henry, and most of history says that he was in desperate need of an heir to the throne, mm-hmm. which is a wrong way to say it. He was in desperate need of a boy heir to the throne. There right. was a girl ready, and she did become queen for a little while, Mary Tudor. She becomes known as Bloody Mary. Some people who visit bars every now and then may know what I'm talking about. What is a Bloody Mary? It must have tomato juice.
Tomato juice and vodka, I think, or I don't know.
Something like that. I'm sure I've had one somewhere along the line. But I really think we should have a, whenever you're at a bar, I think instead of ordering a Bloody Mary, just ask for a Bloody Elizabeth. And the bartender will not know what you're talking about. But you can explain.
You get laughed out of the bar.
Don't you know what a Bloody Elizabeth is? It's tomato juice and vodka. Come on, what are you talking about? No, that's a Bloody Mary. Right. No, that's a Bloody Elizabeth, because Queen Elizabeth had more people killed than Queen Mary did.
Right.
So there's how we go.
Oh, no!
It's sad, but true.
Try it tonight at happy hour.
Indeed. So let's take another quick break. We're going to have to come by, and we're going to have to get back and do a little unraveling of... I think we'll start with Henry VIII. He's the main figure. He's the main figure. We'll be back and we'll do a little unraveling of into his personality and see how it affects history today. I'm Father Tom Coyce, sitting in for Father Anthony Bush. You're listening to Listener Supported, The Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ.
St. Stanislaus Kostka Church is the official sanctuary of the Divine Mercy in Chicago. Founded by Polish immigrants in the late 1800s, this historic church is more commonly known as St. Stan's. One church, many cultures, in that masses are held in English, Spanish, and Polish. The church is two blocks north of Division on Noble, just off the Kennedy. St. Stas has been so prominent in the history of the church in Chicago that the Kennedy Expressway was even built around it. St. Stas is easy to get to. It is the sanctuary for quiet prayer before the celebrated iconic monstrance. For Mass and confession times and special events, please visit our new website at ststanschurch.org. That's ststanschurch.org. And while you're on the homepage, feel free to click on the donations tab to help in the continuing restoration of St. Stas.
The Winds of Change
on AM 750 WNDZ and on the World Wide Web at windsofchangeshow.com.
How long has it been since you have been to church? Busy schedule? Work? Or just lost interest? To be Catholic is not just merely attending Mass as just another weekend activity to be checked off the to-do list. Participation in the sacred liturgy gives you the opportunity to be intimately connected to Christ through the Holy Eucharist. You can also cleanse yourself of sin through the sacrament of reconciliation as a baptized Catholic. Come before the iconic monstrance to be in Christ's presence in the sacred silence of the Sanctuary of the Divine Mercy. St. Stanislaus Kostka Church is open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. St. Stas is just off the Kennedy, two blocks north of Division on Noble. Come back to Christ through the sacred liturgy and his gift of the sacraments at St. Stas.
Hey, welcome back, everyone. Father Coy's here, and I'm trying to help us practice the virtue of holy forgetfulness. That being good Catholics, we have to remember what we're supposed to forget. And I'm on this kick because I'm walking around and I'm here. Most of us are just forgetful. In other words, we don't know what we don't know.
We don't know what to forget.
We don't know what to forget. In order to really appreciate history, the counsel from many leaders is, don't go back into history to discover these problems. Because you'll just get mad and you'll just renew old divisions. And there's enough divisions in the church today. We don't need more divisions. We need less division. There's too much divisiveness. Divisiveness is a key issue that we hear a lot about today. So in the attempt to diminish divisiveness, let us not consider the divisions of the past. Let us only consider how we can forge unity in the future. But my problem is that in order to forge the unity of the future, we got to know what the divisions of the past were so that we can correct them.
Learn from them.
In a better way. And especially because so much of the unity needs to and should come from the centrality of the marriage covenant. And the centrality of family life, and that's what was blown apart, shall we say, or that the Protestant Reformation was a victim of the dysfunctionality of so many families. In order to forge unity in the future, we have to establish the truth about those things. And that's one of the things we're avoiding today, we're ignoring today. And as Hilaire Belloc will say, we ignore it at our own peril.
Wow.
Seeing that.
You just wrinkled my brain, man.
Something like that. Okay, so we're gonna unravel a little bit of King Henry VIII. And one of the things that Hilaire Belloc points out about King Henry VIII, we all know he was a powerful king. Mm-hmm. And if you've seen any pictures of him and you've seen any movies about him, he's a boisterous, strong-willed, and a flamboyant kind of ruler. And but a key thing to know about him in his history is that he was a king of a fairly new dynasty, which I didn't really realize before, but you can go back into the history of all this. And It's easy to find that before the Tudors, which was Henry VIII was one of the family, one of one of the Tudor, part of the Tudor dynasty family, there was the Plantagenet family that had the kings for a good long while. The ancient kingship of England had been in the hands of the family called the Plantagenet for hundreds of years. In the century before Henry was born, the members of this royal family had quarreled. The rightful king had been ousted and put to death by his cousin, and then there had been a reaction against the descendants of this uprising branch, and civil wars had followed between the various parts of the Plantagenet family for two generations. But still, the Plantagenets were the reigning family, and everybody regarded them as the only true royal blood with the right to govern. So when there's, oh, everybody knows that the royal family is there, situated, there's no controversy about whose blood line should be followed. But anyways, it happened about one long lifetime before Henry VIII was born that the widow of one of the Plantagenet kings, a French princess, had secretly taken a lover of low birth, a Welshman employed about the palace, called Tider or Tudor. That's where the name Tudor comes from. His obscure, outlandish name was spelt and pronounced in various ways. Whether she was ever married to him, we do not know, but probably she was not. However, her child by him, and especially the eldest boy, Edmund, were playmates to her own legitimate child by the late Plantagenet king, her husband. And that child, of course, became later the King of England under the Plantagenet title, Henry VI. He showed great favor to his little base-born and probably illegitimate half-brother, Edmund, and married him to a lady who was of Plantagenet blood, though also a couple of generations back illegitimate. Okay, so we got this in order to appreciate. Belloc is trying to paint a picture of Henry VIII as a little more unstable than we might think. He certainly grabbed the power and wanted to rule like an a autocratic monarch. But the fact that he was only the second generation of kings from his dynasty would have made him a little hesitant to buck a real lot of tradition, and especially buck the tradition that England had of being Catholic. England had a proud Catholic history. So anyways, here we go, back to here. These two, Edmund Tudor and his wife, had a boy called Henry. And this Henry Tudor, in the turmoil of the civil wars, became leader of one of the parties. He claimed the throne under the most shadowy rites, came over with a small army of Frenchmen to England from France, where he had taken refuge, was supported by a good many of the nobility who hated the last Plantagenet king, Richard III, and with their help, won the Battle of Bosworth, where this last Plantagenet king, Richard III, was killed. It's so funny that I just, when you watch History Channel and what have you, there was recently a History Channel episode about finding the body of Richard III, and they found it under a parking lot. Isn't that amazing? They figured there used to be an abbey here.
Right.
They knew he was buried in this abbey. The abbey had long since been torn down. There must be a sarcophagus and what have you. And so Richard III was this last of the Plantagenet. And it's in the Protestant English mentality's advantage to poo-poo or shed as dark of a light on the last sort of Catholic dynasty that ruled in England. So that's why Richard III has somewhat of a negative reputation among modern English people today. So Here we go. This is just too interesting. I just got to unpack this here for you. Henry Tudor then took the throne of England and started a new dynasty under the title of Henry the Seventh. So that's Henry the Eighth's dad, who's the first one of this new dynasty, right? As he had hardly any claim, he strengthened his position by marrying the heiress of the Plantagenets. You know, just because you won the war doesn't automatically mean you're going to be king. But he claimed to be king, and so obviously a lot of the population would be wondering, we're not going to take you.
You're not our king.
You're not a Plantagenet at all. And as a matter of fact, but because the Plantagenets had corrupted enough that there was a lot of civil war going on, we just heard that one cousin killed another cousin in order to become a king. That's how things were going on. So it was ripe for a new dynasty, a new family to come to power. So King Henry VII marries one of the Plantagenet girls. She was the niece of the last king and the daughter of the last king's brother, who had been king of England under the title of Edward IV. All this happened in 1485, okay? This is a good 25 years or so before the Great Protestant Reformation. It's time for another break. Oh my goodness, I just got to 1485, and but we're gonna have to come back. Remind me what date we're on.
1485.
Well, God love you for staying with us, my friends. I'm Father Tom Coyes. You're listening to listener-supported The Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ.
Sometimes in life, we are confronted with the tyranny of choice. I know. Stop or go. Hot or cold. Up or down. This way or that way. You can contribute to Winds of Change one way or the other. One way is to go to windsofchangeshow.com. Then click on Support Winds of Change Show in the upper right-hand corner of the page. The other is to go to ststandschurch.org and click on the radio tab to make your donation, one way or the other.
The Winds of Change. The Winds of Change.
On AM 750, WNDZ. And on the World Wide Web at windsofchangeshow.com.
All human life is precious, and all humans are created equal. But not all vitamins are created equal. One company's vitamins stand taller than the rest. At For Life Vitamins, we promote health from the womb to the tomb and support the pro-life movement. Dr. Christosik created For Life Vitamins to optimize your healthy habit of taking vitamins and protect the health of unborn children, the infirmed, and the elderly by donating 10% of sales to support Father Bush's life-changing ministry. Go to forlifevitamins.com or call 888-879-1190. Dr. Christosik has helped over 13,000 patients reclaim their health with For Life's vitamins. Go to forlifevitamins.com or call 1-888-879-1190. Simply change your vitamin company and save a life. Go to forlifevitamins.com or call 1-888-879-1190.
Hey, welcome back, everyone. Father Coyce here. Tony, you were supposed to remind me as we came back.
1458?
59? Yeah, something like that, right?
Somewhere around there.
Right before the Henry VIII time. Right. I was trying to explain how hilarious.
58.
Yeah, I think it was. Well, we're going to jump to 1509, okay?
Good.
15, for those at home with...
That's how the mind works.
Those who are taking notes at home and trying to follow along, you need a scorecard for all of this marvelous stuff.
This Henry VIII character is pretty cool.
He's wild. And it's sad. I did not realize that... The Tudor family was so new and ripe at this time. Even the dynasty before that, Plantagenets, you know, you vaguely know that term, but who knows if you walked, who knows who Plantagenets are? You might think that they were, you know, might be a disease that
sounds
came
like
from
some type
Africa.
Of a plant.
Yeah, exactly. or maybe a shortstop for the Cleveland Indians or something. But that was the dynasty that held the kings in England for hundreds of years before King Henry VIII. And the only non-Plantagenet before King Henry VIII was his father, King Henry VII. And so King Henry VII was the first of the Tudors. Now, everybody knows Tudors because, well, when I say Tudor, does anything come to your mind?
I really can't say.
Every time I hear the word Tudor, I think of a kind of house.
Oh.
You know? It's if you're shopping for houses,
right,
and you say, I saw a few nice houses.
Oh wait, no, the Tudors. Wasn't there
there's a dynasty called the Tudors. Right.
But there's a HBO thing, I think, the Tudors.
And that would be about the dynasty.
The dynasty
royal
before.
Dynasty, right. Yeah, and the HBO series. But I'm talking about a style of homes that most everyone knows about. There's a ranch house, there's the two flat, there's the bungalow, and there's the Tudor. If you didn't know that, the Tudor, I'm pretty sure I got this right. Maybe I have to talk to some of my real estate friends.
A small house, or how does that work?
It could be small or big, but it's characteristic of beams that are set, brown beams that are set in a white plaster wall. Kind of
wow.
Thing. You know, that have sort of angles and...
You just wrinkled my brain.
Well, that's a Tudor house. That's a Tudor house.
Pretty cool.
So next time you see a Tudor house, you got to think of, oh my gosh, I didn't realize Henry VIII was only the second Tudor to gain the throne in England, and that made him vulnerable to the Protestant Reformation. Had he not been so vulnerable, a green... king.
You sure you're not a history professor? Because that would be really cool to remember something.
This is how we have to remember these things. Exactly.
Sure you're not doing that on the side?
Oh, man. I encourage all our listeners to, you know, it really is a fun hobby.
It is.
When you're looking at, when you're looking for fun hobbies, history is certainly ranks up at the top of the top of the list. Right after bonsais, biking, and kayaking, in my humble estimation.
Right.
I don't know. So anyways, let's go back and let's paint more of a picture of Henry VIII because though he was so central in the story of the Protestant Reformation and the establishment of the Church of England, Hilaire Belloc wants to tell us that had it not been for some other more devious characters that hated Catholicism more than he did. Henry VIII didn't really hate Catholicism. He just loved women too much.
Right. He wanted to bend it to his way, right?
Exactly. He wanted to get rid of his wives, and he just kept on falling in love with new. That's where it begins, yeah. And so we need to have a picture of Henry VIII where he wasn't innocent in the whole story.
Far from it.
But he could, without the evil assistance of his evil genius companions or his evil assistant sidekicks.
Mm.
So watch out for sidekicks, my friends. Oftentimes sidekicks are where the kick starts.
Right.
It's where the kick in the butt begins.
Oh, no!
There you go.
Exactly. So, I don't know, what does that say about Nick? We could say, is our producer Armin's sidekick? Would you agree?
No,
Nick,
he's not a sidekick.
You're not a sidekick.
No,
okay, so
he's not
see.
A sidekick.
All right, well, let's not go there.
Armin's got little elves that are sidekicks.
That's enough. Exactly. So, Henry VIII wanted to keep Catholicism, but without the Pope.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very interesting insight about Henry VIII, especially in terms of today. There are many Catholics who like Catholicism by virtue of its tradition, by virtue of its reputation as being the oldest of Christian denominations. of the feeling. There's a lot of feelings associated with being Catholic. Every time we have First Holy Communion, every time we have a confirmation, a wedding, you know, all sorts of feelings come up. And of course, there's a lot of feelings associated with being Catholic. And yet so many Catholics today have this positive feeling about Catholicism, but a negative feeling about the papacy.
Oh.
And especially, it's shifting in the days of Pope John Paul II and Benedict XVI, and you could even say Paul VI, that negative feeling about the papacy had a lot to do with the teachings regarding marriage, and especially artificial contraception and what have you, the rules about divorce and remarriage. All those things built up a negative feeling about the papacy. Now we have Pope Francis, and he's making noises as if to change some of those things, although he's ambiguous enough to not declare it. And I don't think he will change these major issues, but his rhetoric about who am I to judge
sounds that way.
Is changed. Now the Catholics who are negative about the papacy are the more traditional Catholics who are saying you can't change the rules about marriage and sexual morality. But here's this theme that's running through, and Hilaire Belloc wisely points out that Henry VIII would have liked to have kept all of Catholicism except the papacy. He would have liked to have kept all the seven sacraments. As a matter of fact, when they started to write the Book of Prayers, which is kind of like our sacramentary book that would have all the prayers for the different sacraments, he insisted that they keep all seven sacraments. It was whittled down to only the two that survived, not by Henry VIII, but by the more anti-Catholic archbishop, a guy by the name of Cranmer. We'll get to him on another show, I guess. So, oh gosh, and how are we doing with time, Mike? Oh, my goodness gracious. Here's what has to be said then as we conclude our segment, that this Henry VIII had a deep sentimental appreciation for Catholicism, but his avarice, his greed, his lust kept on getting the better of him. And had he met Anne, had the girl that attracted his fancy, Anne Boleyn, been less strict about her not wanting to sleep with someone until she was married, he would have had her, and then he would have gotten tired of her.
Exactly.
She knew that. So, as a matter of fact, Henry VIII slept with Anne Boleyn's older sister, and Henry VIII got tired of Anne Boleyn's older sister, Mary, and pushed her aside, and Anne, the younger sister, said, you had a chance to be queen. You blew it by letting him have you before you got the ring. And so in one sense, she could be a model of a young lady who knows that she's not supposed to go to bed with her boyfriend until she gets the ring. But she was doing it primarily not out of love for King Henry VIII, but as love for the power of being queen. So we're going to have to go into more detail about the nefarious, vicious sidekicks that really pulled the strings of the Protestant Reformation. We have to know these things for today. I'm Father Tom Coyce. This is listener-supported The Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ.
What's there to say when the world makes no sense? Do we search deeper truths or sit on the fence? Can you see? Can you see? Can you see the winds have changed? We marvel and flatter such meaning. the inside is right. It's time to be stirred.